All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is October 20th, Monday, and we're going to start the central nervous system today. And don't forget, 1 week from today, you have a test. So that's going to be on the 27th. Make sure you bring in a good Scantron and an eraser, good eraser. It's on chapters 10, 11, and 12. So that's intro to muscles, all the skeletal muscles, and then intro to nervous system, which we covered the last two periods. Okay, so, oh, let me turn the projector on. All right, so let's see. What do I have up here? I have all of your lectures ready to go. Some people were interested in listening to some of these lectures again, so of course you can go to that website, download those lectures if you want, and if you just want to read the text, you can read the text version of that. And let's see, what else do we have? Blackboard. I put something on there over the weekend. I appended, in kind of a sloppy way, the exam study guide for test number 3. I just put it in over here, the couple figures that I got a copy of, which include the neuromuscular junction and the motor unit. Those actually should be put into this file right here, but you can just download those two figures that I put into a Word document for practice labeling for the test. Okay. Anybody have any questions on that? No? Okay, so let's see what else do we want to do. I guess we're ready to start lecture for central nervous system, unless someone has a question over the regular nervous tissue that we were talking about. Questions about what's in the book or anything like that? Okay, anything on the test? Later. All right, central nervous system. Well, what the heck is the central nervous system? What is a central nervous system? And you might want to get out your notes from nervous system tissue. On that very first page is an overall flow diagram of the nervous system with all the arrows going here and there. So what the heck is a central nervous system as opposed to what other kind of nervous system do you have? The peripheral nervous system, right. So the central nervous system is opposed to the peripheral nervous system. So where do you find the central nervous system located? Brain and spinal cord, right? So deep inside the cranial vault is the brain, and inside the vertebral column is the spinal cord. That is surrounded by a special kind of connective tissue we call the meninges that we're going to look at a little bit. So anything inside the meninges is really part of the central nervous system, including the brain and spinal cord. So I think for us to get an appreciation of the central nervous system, we should even break the central nervous system down into some structural and functional areas to appreciate what's going on. So what we're going to talk about first pretty much is just the brain. And then the last thing we're going to talk about is the spinal cord. Okay, so in particular, the central nervous system can be broken down into 5 general areas, including the spinal cord, but we're going to start in the brain. But we're going to start in the part of the brain that's the lowest, that's closest to the spinal cord. That's the oldest part of our brain in an evolutionary sense. So this is the part of brain that even very primitive animals have, like lizards and snakes and amphibians and things like that. And what is the purpose of the nervous system again? What's the purpose of the nervous system? To communicate with the environment and to regulate things that are happening inside your body. And not just don't think of your body, but think of even like a frog's body or something. So don't forget, a frog has a heart, frog has to breathe, and all of that kind of stuff. So they need a part of the brain that will control all of those things as well. All right, so where do we find these parts? Well, here is the brain, and then here is the spinal cord. All right, so this is central nervous system, and the spinal cord starts right about here, but you can see it changes color, and it goes through a bone right there. What bone does it go through? It goes through the occipital bone, and what's that big hole in the occipital bone called? The foramen magnum. So this is, as it goes through the foramen magnum, that's where we differentiate the brainstem from the spinal cord. All right, so we would see the foramen magnum right about here. All right, so let's look at this area. This is the lowest part of the brain, and this is what we call the brainstem. And the brainstem has three main parts to it. It has the medulla, and if you look at a medulla in lab with a spinal cord, you'll see that the spinal cord is very, very flat, and then it kind of actually steps up. There's a little step right here, a little bump. And that first bump as you're moving away from the spinal cord is the medulla oblongata. Usually we just call it the medulla. And then if you pay close attention, you'll see that there's another little bump or another step up. That's the pons. And then superior to the pons is the midbrain. So we're going to talk about the functions of these three different sections. Right? So these three sections make up the midbrain. Medulla, pons, and midbrain. I mean, these three sections right here make up the brainstem, the medulla, pons, and midbrain. So there's, you have a little picture of it. All right, so what does the medulla do for us? It controls and regulates numerous reflexes in the body. And a reflex is some kind of activity that you don't have to think about that the central nervous system automatically takes care of for you. And what are some of these things? There is a cardioregulatory center in the medulla. And guess what that regulates? Your heart rate, right? As well as force of contraction. And it's the vasomotor center is in the medulla. That controls how much a blood vessel is going to dilate or constrict. So for instance, when your body temperature increases and you get really hot, your blood vessels on your skin vasodilate to take heat away from your body so that you can radiate it off into space, or you can sweat and help and have evaporation cool you down. So you can't control vasoconstriction or vasodilation of your blood vessels. It's the medulla that takes care of it for you automatically. All right. Also in this area, you have the respiratory center. Respiratory center is necessary for breathing. You don't have to consciously think about every breath that you take. Of course, you can control your respiratory rate by using some higher centers in your brain. You could hold your breath, for instance, if you wanted to. But if you couldn't breathe automatically, right, if you had to consciously take a breath every time you needed a breath of air, how could you sleep? Could you sleep? You couldn't sleep, right? So this center, this automatic center in the brainstem is necessary so that you can sleep. It helps regulate your breathing even when you're sleeping. All right, swallowing also is something that's regulated by the medulla oblongata. The initiation of swallowing is a voluntary act, but once you get something in your esophagus, which is the tube from your mouth to your stomach, then the medulla takes over automatically. So have you ever swallowed something 3/4 of the way down into your stomach and have it come back up? You can't stop it, right? Once you start swallowing something, it automatically goes down into your stomach because of the medulla. All right, so the same thing for vomiting. You can't stop vomiting, coughing, sneezing. These things, once they start, you can't stop them. All right. As a matter of fact, if you are in the middle of a sneeze and you hold your breath, what could even happen? Well, your eyeballs could pop out, right? Well, not really, but almost. It will feel really bad because why? You can't stop that sneeze when it starts happening. I was just checking to see if anybody was awake. That's great. Okay. All right. So where is that medulla at? The medulla is this first enlargement or swelling that's just superior to the spinal cord. Okay. All right, there are some longitudinal ridges on the ventral medulla. We call these the pyramids. They carry tracts, motor tracts, in particular the cortical spinal tract. So let's take a look at that. All right, so I see some ridges right here. And that's what we call the pyramids. You might want to take a look at a nice model that we have in lab for the pyramids. So at a tract that's motor, which way are the signals going in a motor tract? Are they coming from the periphery going up to your brain, or do they originate in your brain and then go down the spinal cord to go out to your periphery? Yeah, a motor tract starts in your brain, goes down through the medulla, in particular the pyramids, and then exits via spinal nerves going to your periphery. So the pyramids are in this region. And if we were to rotate the brainstem, we could even see, so for instance, if here is the medulla, right, there's a swelling here and a swelling here, two little ridges on the ventral surface of the medulla. And if we look real close, we're going to see some cross hatches like this. All right, and what's happening here is that the opposite side of the, one side of the brain is controlling the opposite side of your body. So these tracts are actually going to cross over, all right, from one pyramid to the other in this region right here. And we call these little cross hatches right here decussation of the pyramids. When something decussates, that means that it's crossing over from one side of your central nervous system to the other. Okay, and so we would see that also in the medulla. Okay, the pons. Bless you. The pons is a relay center for information between the cerebrum and the cerebellum, and even the spinal cord and the cerebellum. Well, we haven't talked much about the cerebellum yet, but here is the cerebellum right here. That's important for automatically controlling motor function. It's for coordinating motor activity, for instance, when you're walking or running or walking up a flight of stairs, something like that. It's the cerebellum that takes care of your bodies and makes sure that you don't trip and fall, right, on your face. So that's the cerebellum right here. So information can leave the brain stem via the pons. Right, so there are synapses in the pons that then send signals through this bridge right here into the cerebellum. And a bridge in the central nervous system, which has many, many tracts, is what we call a peduncle. So there are peduncles, cerebellar peduncles in the pons. A peduncle is a bridge that's carrying tracts, carrying information in and out of different lobes or major parts of the brain. Okay, and then the last part of the brain stem is the midbrain right here. This sits on top of the pons, and it has a number of different structures. I can see these four little bumps right here, and I can see this other structure that's in the ventral part of the midbrain. These four bumps are what we call the corpora quadrigemina, and the superior two are what we call the superior colliculi. Colliculi is plural. And the inferior two are what we call the, take a guess, inferior colliculi, right? And I want you to appreciate what the function of these are. But in the ventral part of the midbrain, this is what we call the cerebral peduncle. What the heck is a peduncle again? It's a big bridge that's carrying tracts from one major part of your brain to the other. So these are the cerebellar peduncles that connect the pons to the cerebellum. This is the cerebral peduncle because it's connecting the brain stem with the cerebrum. So here's the cerebrum up over here. All right, so this is the only way for signals to get from your spinal cord or from the brain stem up to your cerebrum. Now, let's talk just a little bit about what's the purpose of a cerebrum. What happens in the cerebrum up over here? Something very important. It does a number of really important things, but one thing in particular it does, thought processes. This is the part of the brain when there is electrical activity or action potentials or depolarizations. This is the part of the brain that actually gives you the perception of reality around you. All right, and for sure it's important for thought processes. All right, so when this part of the brain is active, you are appreciating reality. When the cerebrum is activated electrically, you have no conscious perception of what's taking place there. Your body is just working properly. You're not falling on the floor or something like that. All right, when the medulla is working properly, you really don't have any conscious appreciation of that. And the pons, when it's working, or the midbrain, or these corpora quadrigemina, when they're working correctly, you really don't have any perception what's going on there at either. They're just performing their function. Where you have perception of reality is the cerebral cortex that's right on the surface of the cerebral hemispheres. Okay? So in order for you to receive signals from the periphery to generate a sense of reality, a sense of your environment, those signals have to go through this cerebral peduncle to get to the cerebral cortex so that you have a sense of what's happening around you. Okay. Okay, so let's talk about the corporate quadrigemina for just a little bit. The superior colliculus, the superior two nuclei. Oh, what's a nuclei again? What's a nucleus in the central nervous system? And do you have a nucleus in the peripheral nervous system? That's something that maybe could be on the test on Monday, because I think we talked about a ganglion versus a nucleus. Where do you find the ganglion and where do you find a nucleus and what's inside of these structures? Okay, so both a nucleus and a ganglion contain nerve cell bodies and dendrites. Okay, nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And how does that look to the naked eye? It looks gray because, why is that? It's non-myelinated. Dendrites, nerve cell bodies are not myelinated, so we call that gray matter. So a nucleus and a ganglion are myelinated areas, and the nucleus is a non-myelinated area in the central nervous system, and a ganglion is a non-myelinated area in the peripheral nervous system. And in each case, they're going to be composed of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, as opposed to a tract. I think we have used that term before, a tract. What's a tract? Here we said that the pyramids carry motor tracts right here. What the heck is a tract? That's an axon. And can you tell me if it's myelinated or non-myelinated? It should be myelinated. So what does it look like? It's going to look have the appearance of being white because myelin is a lipid, so that's going to give it kind of a whitish color, especially when contrasted with the gray matter of a cell body and dendrite. Yeah? Okay, so a tract is going to be a group of myelinated axons going someplace in the central nervous system. All right, so a tract is what we're going to find in the brain and the spinal cord. But of course, you have axons in the peripheral nervous system that are myelinated. We don't call those tracts because it's not central nervous system. What do we call myelinated axons going someplace in the peripheral nervous system? And that's actually a fairly complicated structure. It's really an organ, and we call that a nerve. Okay, a nerve. We're going to maybe look at some nerves in the next chapter, like the phrenic nerve, an ulnar nerve, brachial nerve. All right, so nerves is white matter in the peripheral nervous system. A tract is white matter in the central nervous system. A nucleus is gray matter in the central nervous system. A ganglion is gray matter in the peripheral nervous system. That's how we think of these things. So the corporate quadrigemina are four nuclei. All right, and they're nuclei because why? Are they in the central nervous system or peripheral nervous system? They're in the central nervous system. So they're performing a certain kind of function because all those nerve cell bodies and dendrites are communicating with each other. The superior two, which we call the superior colliculi, provide for optical tracking. They allow your eyes, the muscles of your eyes, okay, along with your eyes, to fixate on an object and track it in space. Because motion is very important. For instance, if it's a harmful object, you want to get out of the way. Or if it's something you want to eat, you want to be able to track where it's running to so that you can eat it, right? Maybe we don't do that very much anymore, but tracking optical information is very important. But do you have a perception of what you're looking at? All right, if your eyes are fixating on an object, for instance, like if I crumple up a piece of paper and I throw it in the room and I put some spin on it, it's going to curve around through the room, okay? Your eyes can lock on that object and actually watch as it curves and figure out where it's going to end up in some period of time later, right? So baseball players have very well-educated superior colliculi because they can track baseballs even though they're moving very fast and spinning and curving in all kinds of wild directions, right? But in the superior colliculus, do you have the true appreciation for what you're looking at? Where do you have the perception of reality? In your cerebrum, right? Your cerebral cortex. So the superior colliculus just makes your eyes move and track an object, but it doesn't give you a sense of what you're looking at, okay, or any appreciation for that object. It just locks your eyes onto that object. Okay. So, for instance, even if, all right, so here's the cerebral cortex, and the part of the brain that's responsible for appreciation of visual information is the most posterior lobe of the cerebrum. Anybody know what that's called? That's called the occipital lobe. That's where you have the appreciation of vision, in the occipital lobe. So, for instance, even if somebody does not have an occipital lobe, their eyes, because of the superior colliculi right here, if they're healthy, their eyes will still track objects in space. All right? But will that person have any, if they don't have an occipital lobe, will they have any appreciation of that object? No, they won't. Okay? And that was a really interesting case that was in the news maybe about 2 years ago. There was a lady in Florida, not quite sure exactly what happened to her, but she stopped breathing for maybe 10 or 15 minutes, something like that. But when does your brain die? 3 minutes, that's right. After 3 seconds, you're unconscious because you run out of ATP, and after 3 minutes, then your brain dies, especially the cerebral cortex right here. Well, she stopped breathing for a long time and then was revived. All right, she never regained consciousness because, what can you tell me about her cerebral hemispheres right here? They were dead, right? And even at that time, when they would take an image of her brain, they just found fluid. There was no brain left there at all, but there still was brain stem, so that when a physician would walk into the room and place something in front of her eyes and move it, her eyes would do what? Would track the object. And for an uneducated person, what did that look like when her eyes were tracking that object, like a pen or a light or something? It looked like she was actually observing whatever that object was and following it around in space. But in reality, that person had absolutely no idea what was going on around her because her brain was completely dead. Okay, so I think that was actually kind of a shame. This is kind of an interesting religious slash political slash legal issue. Right? She was kept alive on a ventilator even though she had no brain left because she still was exhibiting some signs of actually looking at an object. Okay. No, she was not seeing anything. There were no signals going up to the occipital lobe because the occipital lobe was completely gone. It had died. Okay, because that's the job of the superior colliculi in the brainstem. Okay, so many organisms, frogs, toads, snakes, can track objects in space, okay, but they don't have the same perception of, you know, humans. Okay, so this is that part of the brain that allows you to track objects. And that's independent from your ability to perceive and appreciate what you're seeing. Okay? Yeah. That was the Schiavo case, yeah. Terry Schiavo. Yeah. Yeah, question. Yeah, question.
How do you explain the guy who broke the world record for staying underwater for so long?
Oh, I hadn't heard that. How long did he stay underwater? Over 17 minutes. Okay. Well, there are some very interesting things about our brain that we're just beginning to realize. And for instance, all of us, in one part of our life, we were able to not breathe for a long period of time. And that's, and some of you might be familiar with that, and that is when we're born. Okay, so we know that newborn babies in the process of being born can go without breathing for really long periods of time, maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes. We hate for that to happen, but for instance, if there's a complication during delivery and an umbilical cord gets wrapped around the infant's neck or something, which can happen, they can survive miraculously, and we don't understand what's happening to people's brains when that happens. Okay, so that's an ongoing, interesting study. Okay. So there's probably a way that our brain can go into a state of suspended animation, protect the ATP so it doesn't use it up, and then when breathing starts, the brain activity can restart itself. Yeah.
He also took pure oxygen for like 5 or 10 minutes.
Okay, so he loaded on oxygen. Okay, so he had a little extra oxygen. So there is something interesting called a diving reflex in mammals, because some mammals, like whales, can actually dive quite deep. And if you put cold water on your face, maybe you would do this in a physiology lab, ice water on your face, your heart rate is going to plummet. It's going to drop. All right. And when your heart rate drops, how much energy is it using? Very little, right? If you're exercising a lot, right, if you start to walk up these stairs, what are you going to start doing? You're going to start hyperventilating, right? But if you're just very relaxed, you can protect the energy or the ATP that's in your body. So when somebody maybe did that dive for very, very deep, maybe a couple things were happening there, that cold temperature and maybe that state of meditation slowed their heart rate down, plus all metabolic activity in their body slowed down to where they didn't run out of ATP. But that's sort of interesting about I know divers do like to hyperventilate sometimes before they go for a dive. And when you hyperventilate, you are absorbing some additional oxygen, but you're also getting rid of a lot of CO2. And it's sort of dangerous because CO2 provides you the drive to breathe. That's what tells you to take a breath. But if you hyperventilate and get rid of a lot of CO2, then you don't have that natural signal for you to take a breath. And that's why people that go dive like to do that. But just because you don't have that signal to breathe, you can still run out of oxygen. Right? So a number of people have died because they hyperventilate, get rid of carbon dioxide, dive real deep. They never get the urgency to breathe because they don't have a buildup of CO2 in their body. But then they run out of oxygen. And when they run out of oxygen, what happens to them? They black out, and then they're under the water, and they're blacked out, and then their respiratory center takes over, like in the medulla and the pons, and they start to breathe underwater even though they're unconscious. Then what happens to you? Well, then you never wake up again, right? Okay, so these are some interesting things having to do with diving physiology and how the brainstem is working. Okay, and that'd be really nice someday if we could figure out how to protect somebody's brain like an infant when they stop breathing. Right? If we were able to turn somebody's brain on and off, because that would be very, very protective. And the same thing for the heart. When the heart is beating, does it use energy or not energy? It uses energy when it's contracting, right? So whenever you're going to remove a heart from somebody, maybe donate it to somebody else, you want to stop the heart. And when you stop the heart from contracting, you can preserve it for a long period of time by maintaining the energy or the ATP inside the heart. But once it starts contracting again, it uses up the ATP and it dies very quickly as a result. And that's really what's so bad about fibrillation, because when somebody's heart dies in fibrillation, what is the heart doing? It's beating very rapidly, but in an uncontrolled fashion, and it's using up all the energy. That's why fibrillation is such a deadly kind of condition to have. Okay. All right, so that's a brainstem. What else do I want to show you about the brainstem? The cerebral peduncles carry tracts from the brainstem up to the cerebral hemispheres for your appreciation of reality around you. And then there's another area that we call the reticular formation. And the reticular formation is found within the pons and the medulla. So it's just a generalized area. And an interaction between many nuclei in these two areas right here. So it's not really a nice structure like the superior colliculus or the inferior colliculus. It's more generalized. And this is important because it has reverberating circuits in it. Did I draw on the board what a reverberating circuit was for you guys? Did we talk about serial processing and parallel processing? Yeah, I think I actually drew a reverberating circuit. And that is when you have one neuron synapsing on a second neuron, and maybe even a third one. This would be an example of serial processing when an electrical impulse goes from one to the second to the third neuron, right? But, so it's just a series, okay? But a reverberating kind of circuit means that when an electrical impulse gets to this last neuron, it actually has a collateral axon that comes back and stimulates the first neuron again. So that once this circuit is stimulated, what happens? It self-stimulates itself and it keeps stimulating over and over and over again. So this is the kind of circuit that we see in the medulla and the pons. And it makes up the reticular formation or reticular activating system. But of course, this can't work forever and ever and ever, because what happens? These neurons fatigue, they run out, they run low on energy, and when they fatigue, what happens? That's when somebody falls asleep. Okay, so that's why it's very necessary for us to sleep some part of the day, because this reverberating circuit can't work forever and ever and ever. Okay, and that, can anybody know what that condition's called? For instance, when there is maybe a lesion in this circuit someplace, could be a metabolic lesion or it could be an anatomic lesion. That's called narcolepsy. All right, and that means that somebody could just fall asleep at any time as a result of that. And sometimes the diagnosis is difficult. Sometimes the treatment, it takes a long time to treat somebody, maybe 6 months before it's under control, if at all. So here we have, so I tried to find on YouTube something about narcolepsy, and the only reputable one that I think I could really find was with some animals, because I really wasn't sure what I was looking at. There's some YouTubes on people falling asleep, but you know, I could say, hey, how about if you just pretend you're falling asleep and I'll buy you lunch? Okay, so I'm not so sure that I can trust, you know, unless it's from a reputable medical school someplace. But people can just fall asleep or pretend they're falling asleep. But animals really don't pretend very much, right? So here's a dog, and I'm pretty sure they haven't trained this dog.
There is a small dog with a very big problem.
So, just falls asleep. Okay, so more importantly in this class is what part of the brain is responsible for letting this poor little puppy down? It's the reticular activating system, right? Part of the brainstem, namely the medulla and the pons. Okay, so you could do a search and find some others. Okay, so the reticular activating system is in this part of the brain right here. And, oh, there's something else. All right, so here are the superior colliculi, therefore optical tracking. The inferior colliculi, these two down over here, also have an important function, but it's not for visual information, it's for auditory information. With the inferior colliculi, they allow you to localize sound. So what does localize mean? To figure out where it is in space, right? So if I had a pin and I poked you on the arm, you could localize it. You could say, oh, left arm. Right, or ear, right ear, right, or elbow, or whatever. That's localization. Well, you can do that with sound as well. Even if my eyes were closed, because I have normal inferior colliculi, with my eyes closed, I could tell if someone opened up that door over here, or this door over there, or that one up over there, or that one up over there, because I would get auditory information arriving at my ears at different times, and it's the inferior colliculus that would say, oh, the sound arrived at your right ear before your left ear, so it has to be something on the right side of your body. So that's how you localize sound. Yeah.
So does that kind of like the whole if you lose one sense, then your other one is still working?
Your other senses certainly will be heightened. You'll learn how to appreciate how to use those senses more, but I don't think by knowing something about the colliculi how that shows that in particular, okay? But yeah, if you're, for instance, since I'm colorblind, then obviously I can't use color for a lot of information, right? So if I order a pizza and it has green peppers on it, and if I'm allergic to green peppers, how do I know not to eat that part of the pizza? Well, I can't see green, but I can see shapes really well, right? So I just look at the shape of the stuff that's there, and I just don't eat the things that are shaped like green peppers, right? So yeah, you learn how to view reality a lot different, okay? I could tell, yeah, by smell and stuff like that. I could actually tell you sort of an interesting little story. I was interviewing for a job one time. So I grew up in Illinois. This is really quick. Grew up in Illinois, and I don't think we had many Chinese restaurants in our neighborhood where I was growing up. So I went to San Francisco, and I was interviewing for this really important job, right? So I gave the interview, and then the boss who was going to hire me took me out for lunch. And so we went to this vegetarian tofu Chinese restaurant, right? So they don't serve any meat, but they made shrimp out of tofu to make it look like shrimp and chicken and stuff like that. So I ordered Kung Pao shrimp, and it was really nice. I'm eating it and all that kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden, I couldn't hardly breathe. I couldn't hardly talk. And he leaned over and he said, well, you know, you shouldn't eat those little red things in there. So I was eating all those chili peppers because I had no idea what they were. So here I was interviewing for the job of my lifetime, and what happened? I couldn't even talk, couldn't even hardly breathe. So that's really kind of funny. So yeah, you do compensate, but now I know what a red chili pepper looks like, not by its color, but by its shape. Right. So there are ways that you do compensate for whatever deficits you have. Okay. All right, the diencephalon. The diencephalon is the next highest part of the brain. All right, so it sits on top of the brain stem, and it's got two parts, the thalamus and the hypothalamus. Guess what hypothalamus means? It means below the thalamus in an anatomical sense, right? It's inferior to the thalamus. So we're going to look at the thalamus in just a second. This is a relay station for sensory information on its way from the spinal cord up to the cerebral cortex. So let's see if we can find where this thing is at. All right, so here is the diencephalon, and this thing that kind of looks like a little egg or a walnut right here, this is the thalamus. And all signals coming up from the spinal cord going through the midbrain have to synapse here at the thalamus, and it's the job of the thalamus to tell where in the cerebral cortex that signal should go. All right, so there is a synapse right here. And without the thalamus, signals won't reach the cerebral cortex for your appreciation of whatever modality that is. So that's a relay center. Where else did we look at a relay center? That was in the pons is a relay center for signals going up to the cerebrum or down from the cerebrum into the spinal cord that makes its way into the cerebellum right here. Okay, so you do have different relay centers in the brain. What does it mean to relay a signal? What's a relay mean?
Translate.
Maybe translate it, but another way of thinking of it, let's say that you and I have a class later in the afternoon. Okay, we're taking a class, but I can't make it. So I want to write a note to the instructor telling the instructor, oh, I have a doctor's appointment. And so I say, well, why don't you just tell the instructor for me that I can't be there, but I'd really like to be there and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I'll make sure I get all the notes and whatever. And so then you carry that information as a relay to the instructor, right? So that's just relaying information. Okay, that's what a relay is. Okay, so the thalamus is also important for your appreciation of mood and also generalized pain. So this is the first center in our brain that can give you the sense of pain. And is that a good sense? Is that a proper sense for you to have? Yeah. What is pain the result of? The pain is a result of tissue damage, right? So of course you want to be aware of that because you want to minimize whatever tissue damage is occurring to you, right? So pain in this sense is a very good thing for you to perceive because you want to take your body away from that stimulus that is producing tissue damage, yeah. SIPA. SIPA? Did I hear you right?
CIPA.
I'm going to have to do a Google on that. I don't know. You know, a lot of acronyms I don't know, but if you tell me what it means.
Simply put, though, not being able to
feel pain. Ooh, yeah, this really dangerous condition. Yeah, very dangerous condition. I think I saw something on TV once about it, but I don't remember much about that. Somebody that can't perceive pain has to be really careful, has to use their eyes a lot to make up for that lack of sensation, right? Because, well, you could amputate part of your body and not even know it, right, if you don't feel pain. Yeah. There might be some other, yeah.
Because of the fact that they get into a lot of accidents and like they'll have their hand over stove and burn their hand.
Yeah, their body just gets beat up without them even knowing about it. Yeah. So in that sense, pain is a really good sensation to have, right? Because you always want to minimize tissue damage. All right, the hypothalamus. This is an important homeostatic control center of your body. It takes care of a number of things automatically as well. You don't have any conscious thought of what's going on in the hypothalamus, but it controls hunger and thirst and your body temperature. Because what can you tell me about your body temperature? Does it, like, is your body temperature decreasing right now because the temperature in the room here is about 70 degrees? At the end of class, is your body temperature going to be 70? No, it's going to stay at 98.6, right? All right, so that's what we mean by homeostasis. Your body is controlling itself. It's maintaining a constant environment that's suitable to support life. And the same thing for hunger. If you never experience hunger, you'd probably just waste away. Or thirst, you would dehydrate. All right, and if you stimulate this part of the brain, okay, that can produce a false sense of hunger or thirst, for instance. All right, what drug, you know, stimulates a false sense of hunger? Don't know any. Okay, I bet you do. Okay, like tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the active ingredient in marijuana. All right, will stimulate your hunger center and your hypothalamus. What about thirst? Anybody know a drug that can inappropriately give you the sensation of thirst? Yeah, which is ecstasy. Yeah, ecstasy can stimulate your thirst center in the hypothalamus. And I suppose that could be dangerous because can anybody overdose on water?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be very deadly. Okay, so those are just some things to be concerned with. All right, another important function of the hypothalamus is that it controls the pituitary gland. All right, so let's see if we can find some of these things. So here is the thalamus, and then down in this region right here is a hypothalamus. And then, so here's the hypothalamus right here. It's loaded with different nuclei for controlling all these different functions. And here is the pituitary gland. Now, where does that pituitary gland sit? What bone is that in? That's in the sphenoid bone. And what part of the sphenoid bone? The neck. Okay, well, you got two greater wings, two lesser wings. So it's probably not in a wing. It's probably going to be right in midline, right in the middle. That's the sella turcica, all right, that little depression in the body of the sphenoid bone. That's where the pituitary gland is. And the pituitary gland is the master endocrine control gland in your body. It controls testes, ovaries, thyroid gland, adrenal gland. It controls many, many other kinds of endocrine glands. And it gets its information from the hypothalamus. So sometimes the hypothalamus releases hormones that go into the anterior pituitary. Other neurons in the hypothalamus have big, long axons that go into the posterior pituitary that release hormones. Right? In any case, everything, the communication between the hypothalamus and the pituitary is through this little tissue stalk right here. So sometimes we call that the infundibulum or the pituitary stalk. And I actually like to call it another little thing. Remember what we called bridges between major parts of the brain? What did we call that? Like the peduncles. Here's the cerebellar peduncle. Here's that big bridge between the brain stem and the cerebrum. That's the cerebral peduncle right here. Well, you could think of this as being a peduncle, but it's a little bridge between the hypothalamus and the pituitary. So what would we call a little bridge? That's what I would call a peduncolito. Okay? But don't tell anybody I told you that. Okay, that's a little peduncle right there. We call it the infundibulum. That's a connection between the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland. Nonetheless, that's a very important structure because otherwise you would lose control of the pituitary gland if you didn't have that operating. Okay. All right, so that's pretty good for, we talked about the brainstem, talked about the diencephalon, and now the cerebrum. This is the largest portion of the brain. All right, so let's take a look at some of these things. So here is the cerebrum, right here, and we can see some structures deep because they're nicely color-coded, and the cerebrum does not include the cerebellum right here. So the cerebrum has some five major lobes to it. What is this lobe right here? That's the frontal, and then the parietal, and then the occipital, and then this one right here is the temporal lobe, right? So these are just underneath those major cranial bones. So it's really easy to remember what all these are. But notice that the surface of the brain is not flat, right? It is all folded up. So, for instance, what gives an animal intelligence is the number of cells that are in the most superficial layer of the brain, which is what we call the cortex. All right, so the cortex of the brain has to have a large surface area to incorporate trillions of cells. Well, how do you take something that has a big surface area and put it into a small space like your cranium? What would be one way to do that? Fold it up. That's right. So the brain has all of these folds on it so that it sits inside your head, right? Because there'd be no reason why I would like to have a head that was 3 feet wide and 3 feet deep, right? So it's all folded up so it fits inside our head. And those folds are what we call convolutions. So a convolution is something that has lots of twists and turns into it, right? So a convoluted argument, how would you consider a convoluted argument? Straightforward or one with a lot of twists and turns? A lot of twists and turns. And this is actually kind of an apropos season, because what could you read right now that's highly convoluted? Politics, for instance, or propositions, California propositions, right? You have to really sit down and read these things to figure out what they're talking about. And then you may or may not be able to actually figure out what's going on. That's convoluted. Right, so convoluted just means a lot of twists and turns. So a convolution has a high point or a ridge, that's what we call a gyrus, and there is also then a corresponding depression, which is what we call a sulcus. Right, so a convolution has those two parts, a sulcus and a gyrus, and the brain, or the cerebral cortex, has numerous sulci and gyri, and they all have names, and I think you only have to really know two in here. All right, and there is a nice separation between the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe, and we call this the central sulcus. Can you see that right here? That's the central sulcus. That's the line of demarcation between the frontal and the parietal bone. And then you see ridges on either side. And so that's a gyrus. So this is what we call the precentral gyrus, because that's in front of the central sulcus. Here is the postcentral gyrus, which is posterior to the central sulcus. Okay, so now let's talk about some functions of the brain. The frontal lobe right here, and in particular the precentral gyrus, is important because that's what initiates motor activity. That's consciously how you're controlling skeletal muscle in your body. So if you grab a pen or grab a glass and take a drink of water or something, that's the part of the brain that is designating or stimulating those muscles into contraction. So this is what we call the primary motor cortex, because what's a motor signal? Starting in your brain, going out to the periphery. That's efferent or motor. And that's where all these signals start, right up over here. All right, that's in the frontal lobe. The parietal lobe, from here to here, right, and in particular the postcentral gyrus, that's not important for motor activity, but that's where you have the perception for things that are happening on the surface of your body. For instance, pain, temperature, tickling, itch, whatever, okay, is appreciated in this part of the brain, the postcentral gyrus. So, for instance, if we apply an electrical stimulus in this part of the brain over here, all right, what's going to be the result? Is it going to be perception? Is it going to give you a perception, or is it going to move a part of your body if I stimulate the postcentral gyrus? It's going to be perception because the parietal lobe, and in particular this postcentral gyrus right here, is the primary sensory cortex in your body. All right, so if there's damage to this part of the brain, you won't be able to perceive those sensations. But as opposed to if we stimulate this part of the brain, what's going to happen? Okay, you might not feel anything because this lobe is not for perception. It's motor, that's right. It's going to cause some part of your body to move, just as if you were wishing that part of your body to move. Right, because the precentral gyrus is what we call the primary motor cortex.
It would be kind of like a reflex?
Yeah, it would just happen. Right. It would just happen. So that would cause an action potential to move down, right, down through the spinal cord to those muscles corresponding to however it is mapped to this part of the cerebral cortex right here. Okay, let me just see if there's anything else I want to say. Yeah, I want to say a lot more about some of these things. Okay, so let's look now at, you have a lot of good figures in your book, and again, you can see what, occipital, parietal, frontal, temporal. There's one lobe that we didn't talk about, and that's deep to the temporal lobe, that's the insula, but you can kind of pull the insula back and take a look, I mean the temporal lobe back and take a look at the insula. Here is just a nice cross-section of the surface of the brain. Right, and we can see a sulcus and a gyrus, and right on the surface of the brain contains gray matter. Deep to the gray matter is white matter. So even though this is gray matter, we don't really call that a nucleus, we just call that the cerebral cortex or the cerebrum. Now what do we find in this white matter right here? What's in this white matter? It's myelinated axons going someplace, and we're going to learn how to talk about these axons in just a little bit. Okay. Here's the insula. If we fold back the temporal lobe. Okay, so here is that central sulcus right here. There are some other very deep depressions in the brain. They're actually a lot deeper than a sulcus. So here is the longitudinal fissure. This is separating the cerebral hemispheres. So the cerebral hemispheres really are two separate identities separated by the longitudinal fissure. That shows that nicely. Okay. Now here is a very interesting picture because we have taken, let me see if I can see a part of the brain. We've taken the brain, like here is that central sulcus. We've taken one slice of the brain right through this gyrus. What is this gyrus called again? That's anterior here. So here is the precentral gyrus and here is the postcentral, and the precentral is what function again?
Motor,
right? And the postcentral is sensory. Now, how can you remember that? What's an easy way to remember that the frontal lobe is motor?
The motor's in the front and the sensor's in the back.
This is true. If you can memorize that, that's fine. But I think of an analogy. You said it so nicely because in your car, where's the motor? In the front, in most cars. Right, unless somebody has a motor that has a car with a motor in the middle. Anybody have a car with a motor right smack in the middle? No? Well, that's too bad because they're really fancy cars. They're really nice because if they start spinning out of control, how do they spin? They just spin in a nice straight line. Right? If you have a motor in the front, then your car is going to be really out of control. But that's probably not so important in everyday life. Okay. So the motor is in the front. Same thing for our cerebrum. All right, so that's what we're looking at here. We're going to take one slice from the precentral gyrus and one slice from the postcentral gyrus and look at its function. And this is what we have right here. Now, I bet there's another color-coded slide, and I really can't appreciate this, but here's the central. This all looks blue to me, and this all looks like red or something. So that's not very helpful. All right, so let's look at this. here is where it's color-coded. All right, so the red is what lobe? Frontal or parietal? Frontal, so that's going to be motor, right? So if we stimulate this area here electrically, that's going to produce what? Sensation or some motor action?
Motor action.
Right. Furthermore, What this diagram shows you is how the surface of the body maps out to the surface of the brain. All right, so this part of the precentral gyrus is going to control your face, right, and then your tongue. So if we stimulate, say, this area right here with an electrical current, what's going to happen? You're going to blink, okay? That's going to control motor activity around your eye. And you could probably even tell me the name of that muscle. What's that muscle? Yeah, that's orbicularis oculi, is controlled by neurons in this part of what? The precentral gyrus. But not up over here. Because if we stimulate, for instance, this part of the precentral gyrus, what's going to happen? That's going to contract what muscles? Okay, this one right here? Well, I would guess, so here's here's arm. This is what I was looking at. Okay, right here. Let's say this one right here. Because that's going to be in the brachium someplace. So it's going to cause like a biceps, like somebody will punch themselves in the face, right, if we stimulate that area. All right. And what surface of the brain controls, can you see a surface of the brain that is very large compared to some small surface area on your body? For instance, what's the surface area of your face compared to the surface area of your whole trunk? Like here is thorax, right? And here is your hips, right? Here's your thighs. What area, what surface area on the brain is larger? Your face or your trunk over here? Your face. That means that you have many more neurons that control your face compared to your trunk. And does that make sense? Yeah, because what do you do with your face? Well, you breathe and you eat, right? And you also communicate. So there's a lot of processing power for communication, for the spoken language. But when you communicate with somebody, it's what? Not just what you say, it is what? How you say it, right? And also the facial expression that you use when you communicate information. As a matter of fact, you can probably communicate very well just with facial expression and not saying anything at all, right? Like, I could go, I didn't say a thing, okay? All right, so you do communicate a lot. So this, because it looks like a person right here, we call that a homunculus. So here's a homunculus diagram. And this, of course, is the precentral gyrus. Stimulation of this area or electrical of this area is going to cause motion. But the blue over here, where's the blue coming from? From the postcentral gyrus. And if we were to stimulate, for instance, this area right here, what would happen with an electrical current? Would your foot move? Not necessarily right away. You would have what? The perception of something happening on your foot, even though nothing was really happening on your foot, right? Maybe a tickling sensation or something, which then you would then use this part of your brain to move your foot away from that stimulus. Okay. All right, and again, you can see the nice sensory pattern that we have from the face, and as a matter of fact, the most highly sensitive part of your body actually are your lips right here. That's the most sensitive part of your body. We call that two-point discrimination. We can take two pins and we can move them close together or farther apart, and your lips, we can move the pins very, very close together and you can still tell that it's two objects poking you. And if we were to poke the back of your hand, it would only feel like one. It would have to be really far apart before you could tell it was two pins. All right, the other part of your body that's highly sensitive is what? Your fingertips. Okay, because they take up a lot of the surface area of the brain. So the prefrontal gyrus is what we call the primary motor cortex. The postcentral gyrus is what we call the primary sensory cortex, or the primary somatic sensory cortex. Somatic just means on the surface of your body. All right, so you should know something about how that brain is organized. Okay. All right, so speech is very important. Let me see if I can find another figure right here. Ah, here's a good Well, now this is not an exam figure because it's got way too much information on it, but I think it's still important for you to look at because you can see what? Occipital lobe and temporal, parietal, and frontal lobe. All right, the area for speech, all right, which is right here. So what is speech? Is that perception or is that a motor activity? So speaking is a motor activity, right? And the area in our brains that allows us to communicate is called Broca's area. And of course, then you would automatically know that Broca's area has got to be in the frontal lobe someplace because that's the motor part of our brain. As opposed to understanding language. How do we understand language? Is that a motor or is that a sensory modality? That's sensory, right? So we're going to look at somebody's facial expression. We're going to hear auditory signals from our ears. All right, so speech is kind of complicated. The primary auditory cortex is in the temporal lobe. That's where you hear sounds, but you won't be able to appreciate language unless the temporal lobe shares that information with this area in the parietal lobe. And this is what we call Wernicke's area. But what else did we say was important for appreciating language? Not just what we hear, but also what we see. The primary visual cortex is the occipital lobe. So when we're communicating with somebody, we see their facial expression, we hear the words that they're using. These two kinds of information coalesce right here in Wernicke's area to give you the appreciation for what they're saying. So that's in the parietal lobe. All right, so temporal lobe is important for hearing, and the occipital lobe is important for visual information. Okay, the prefrontal cortex, way out in the front of the frontal lobe, this is for cognition. So this is how you learn to deal with, or this is how you deal with reality, all right, in appropriate ways, the prefrontal cortex. Damage to this area right here would cause personality changes. And in psychology, they always talk about Phineas Gage. This was a person that was working on a railroad, and he was setting some dynamite, and the dynamite went off unexpectedly and took a big metal spike that was probably about 3 feet long, and it went up through his mandible and out through his frontal lobe. And it didn't hurt his eye, but it destroyed that part of the frontal lobe, and he lived just fine after they got the bleeding. But he was never the same person, okay? Because before that injury, he showed up to work on time, did his homework, read his textbook assignments, just kind of kidding, right, because he worked on a railroad. But nonetheless, he was very appropriate all the time. And then after damage to the frontal lobe, showed up to work late, got into fights all the time, just lost his social awareness, his social skills as a result of that. So that's the job of the prefrontal cortex. Okay, all right. And I think we talked about the basal nuclei. So let's take a nice coronal section through the brain. And we don't see this slide very much in lab, so I want to mention this in lecture. Here's the thalamus, then the hypothalamus, okay, here and here. And these are gray areas in the brain. So how would you characterize this gray area in the brain? Is that a tract? It would be a nucleus. So these are various nuclei inside the brain that are performing certain kinds of functions. And these out over here are what we call the basal nuclei. But look how old your book is. It calls them the basal ganglia because they used to be called basal ganglia for years and years and years, and some textbooks haven't converted back over yet. But what's a ganglia? Strictly a nice definition of a ganglia. A ganglium is what? It's gray matter in the peripheral nervous system someplace. But what are these? These are in the central nervous system. So the proper term would be what? Basal nuclei, right? So you should just scratch off ganglia in your textbook and put nuclei there because that's how everybody should be talking about them now. All right, the basal nuclei right here are important for coordinating muscles. And for instance, when you contract the biceps brachii, in order for your forearm to flex, what has to happen? What has to happen on the opposite side of your body? the triceps has to, yeah, they have to relax. They can't be contracted so that they can extend, right? All right, so that's one characteristic of muscle tissue, is that it is extensible, it is stretching. But for instance, it's the job of the basal nuclei so that when you contract the biceps, the triceps actually relaxes. So the basal nuclei's job is to inhibit muscles from contracting in the proper sense, like the triceps when the biceps is contracting. So what happens if there's damage to the basal nuclei right here? What happens when you try to use your biceps? The triceps doesn't relax, and so your motion is very unwieldy, right? It's very tonic, right? You're like in a constant state of contracture, and you're not very coordinated. Does anybody know what that condition is called? When somebody's motion is very disturbed, that's called Parkinson's disease. And you might actually know some people with Parkinson's disease. And that can be due to trauma to the head that damaged the basal nuclei. And it can be developmental. It can happen naturally, maybe because of genes that you inherit from your parents. And it can also be due to certain kinds of drugs that actually poison the basal nuclei. All right, so usually the normal onset of Parkinson's disease is very late in life. It's rare to afflict somebody early on in life unless they've had trauma to their head or maybe abused drugs or something. So who's a famous person that had early onset Parkinson's disease due to head trauma? Not Michael J. Fox. Muhammad Ali. Right, because he was this big guy that went into the boxing ring and fought other incredibly strong, powerful guys that would hit him in the head, right, and that damaged the basal ganglia. So when he's in public, okay, he has what? Motor deficits. He can't formulate words properly. His gait is disturbed, right? And as a matter of fact, if you look at Muhammad Ali and you don't know that he has Parkinson's disease, what does he kind of look like? He kind of looks intoxicated because he doesn't have fine motor control. All right, I think this is something really important since you guys might be ending up in a clinical setting. You're going to see Parkinson's patients. All right, but is somebody with Parkinson's disease a drug seeker or an alcoholic or something like that? No, absolutely not. Right. So I know a lot of times when you're in a clinical setting, you're very wary of people that are quote-unquote drug seekers because they can be dangerous to you. Right, so you have to protect yourself. But somebody with Parkinson's disease has absolutely normal cognitive function. They're aware of everything around them. Their thought processes are completely normal. They just can't control their body like they would like to. Right, so never treat somebody that has Parkinson's disease like they're an alcoholic or a drug seeker, right, because they're not in the same ballpark at all whatsoever. Okay. And you might meet somebody on the street, and that's always something you should be aware of. You know, is this like if I were to show up and look intoxicated? Of course, you know me, then you would know I'm intoxicated. But the first time, okay, is that appropriate or inappropriate for me to come to class drunk? Yep. Totally inappropriate, right? But somebody that has Parkinson's disease, well, that's just their normal everyday life, right? And you have to deal with that and help them deal with that too. Okay. Now, early onset Parkinson's disease, we're talking about Muhammad Ali due to trauma, but it can also be produced by drug abuse. And probably a good example of that would be Michael J. Fox, but I have to say that we don't really know for sure because Michael J. Fox was always asked on numerous occasions, "Did you ever abuse drugs?" And he said, "No, never, 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 because I'm a Canadian citizen. I came from Canada. We don't even have drugs in Canada." Right? Okay, and so I believe him. But since his condition was diagnosed, a number of other child actors on Family Ties have come down with early onset Parkinson's disease. And so now everybody is supposing that when everybody was really young, okay, on that TV show, they were given Kool-Aid or soda pop or something that was spiked with some kind of stimulant or amphetamine to get the kids acting properly over the long periods of time that they were filming the show, and that poisoned their basal nuclei as a result of that. So you got to be, if you take any kind of drugs, make sure it's nice pharmaceutical quality drugs prescribed by a physician. because you should maybe do a Google search on frozen addicts. And in England, there were a number of addicts that got a batch of heroin that was inappropriately prepared that had contaminants in it, and those contaminants bound to receptors in the basal nuclei and destroyed the basal nuclei. So they were frozen in place for the rest of their lives. Normal cognitive function, right? They can think clearly. They just couldn't move anymore as a result of that. Actually, I should get a YouTube of that and show you that. Okay, so what's the importance of the basal nuclei? For motion, controlling motion. And there's the neurotransmitter. Well, we talked about neurotransmitters. The neurotransmitter of the basal nuclei is dopamine. Yeah, they're deficient in dopamine. For some reason, those neurons are damaged. They don't produce dopamine. And the treatment then would be any kind of treatment that can enhance the effects of dopamine, right? And we're hoping maybe even transplant of dopaminergic neurons into that part of the brain can alleviate Parkinson's disease. So there's some hope that even like embryonic stem cell research might help somebody with Parkinson's disease. Okay. All right, so we talked about all those different lobes of the brain. Let's talk about white matter. White matter in the central nervous system make up what we call tracts. It's carrying information over long distances. And there are different ways that information can be transmitted. Right? Remember we said that the left and right hemispheres aren't connected to each other, right? Because there's a big longitudinal fissure between them. Right, so the right side of the brain doesn't necessarily know what the left side is doing or thinking. And the different sides of the brain actually perform different tasks. Well, there is a part of the cerebrum where there is a connection between the right and left hemispheres. And those fibers or those tracts are what we call commissural fibers. Commissural tracts interconnect corresponding gray areas of the right and left hemispheres. They're horizontally aligned. A good example would be the corpus callosum and the anterior commissure. So let's see, where do we find these things? Ah, right here. All right, so here is, right, I don't know which hemisphere is which, so I'll just say this is the left hemisphere, here's the right hemisphere. Let's just say we're looking from the anterior side, looking back at somebody. All right, so here is the longitudinal fissure, the separation between the hemispheres. But here are tracts, and it's nicely colored, but white right here, right? So these are tracts going between the right and left hemispheres. So this is one way for the different sides of the hemispheres to communicate with each other. This structure right here, if we were to find a nice sagittal section, that's what we would call the corpus callosum. Okay, so the corpus callosum, I don't know if I can quite see it. Okay, the corpus callosum is a C-shaped structure right in this area, right here. Okay, other kinds of fibers or white matter interconnect gray areas within the same hemisphere. We call these association fibers. For instance, between the visual center in Wernicke's area and the auditory cortex in Wernicke's area, these are association fibers. They're more horizontally aligned. They're very short. What do these look like? So these would be association fibers because they're staying at the same level of the brain and they're not going from the left and right hemispheres, right? They're staying within one hemisphere. So these are association fibers. And the last kind of fiber that we have are what we call projection fibers. So for instance, here is the thalamus. And in order for you to perceive those sensations that are synapsing in the thalamus, they have to move to the cerebral cortex. All right, so these are what we call projection or radiation fibers that are carrying information from a lower level in the brain to higher levels in the brain, but again, not crossing over. They're not commissural fibers at all. So these are what we call projection tracts or projection fibers right here. Right, the cerebellum. You should know where the cerebellum is. It's underneath the occipital lobe, and it's important for balance and coordination. It constantly adjusts postural muscles to maintain balance, and it programs and fine-tunes complex motor movements. So, for instance, whenever you have a good idea and you want to move your body someplace, right, you're going to initiate that motion with what part of your brain? What part of your brain is going to control skeletal muscles so that you can move around? It's going to be the precentral gyrus, right? And so your body is going to start to move, but you also have sensors in your arms, actually all your joints and all your muscles. We call that the sense of proprioception. It's one of the last chapters in nervous system that we're going to look at. So these are all sensors that are giving information to the brain, telling you how much tension is in a muscle, what the angulation of a joint is, what position your body is in space. So, for instance, if I were to say, close your eyes, and I were to grab your arm and take your hand and put it above your head, you could tell me, oh, well, my hand's above my head, even with your eyes closed, right? Because you know what position your body is in. That's due to proprioception. So these sensors are sending information to the cerebellum, which is right here, and then it also gets information from the precentral gyrus saying where you want your body to be. All right, well, let's just say that the cerebellum is getting information that your hand is behind your head, but it's getting information from the precentral gyrus that your hand should be above your head. What's wrong with that? Where you want your hand to be is not where it is, right? And so the cerebellum says, ah, there is what? Everything is fine, or there is an error. The cerebellum says, ah, there's an error. If you really want your hand above your head, you got to do what? You got to move it. So the cerebellum makes those little adjustments to place your body where you think it should be, okay? But you don't really know. It's the cerebellum that really knows what position it's in. So it corrects for errors in body motion. For instance, if you're walking down a sidewalk and you trip on a crack in the sidewalk, all of a sudden your body is not where it should be. Guess who knows that first? It's the cerebellum, and then it makes for corrections right away by contracting or relaxing other muscles so that you don't fall on your face. So that's the job of the cerebellum right here. Okay, so I guess this is where I ended last time. So that's where we're going to start next time. All right, we're going to start with the spinal cord. So you might want to review that stuff. We don't have too much. Oh, yeah, we got to talk about the meninges yet and all that kind of stuff. So that's where we're going to start next time.